Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Chris Bernor.
Dwayne is out on vacation this week, and Devendra got called in to another podcast. So replacing VentureBeat editor Devendra Hardarar, we have VentureBeat staff writer Sean Ludwig as our ringer this week. How are you doing, Sean?
I'm doing great. It's kind of fun to fill in for who is technically my boss.
For the people in the on the podcast that aren't familiar with you, because we've had you on the show before, but it's been a while. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you cover there on VentureBeat?
Yeah, so I've been covering tech for, about 4 years. And for VentureBeat, I cover mobile and cloud and media companies. I dabble in social as well. And, you know, basically when you cover tech, you kind of have to have some broad interests. So, you know, I've got my hands in everything. Kind of fun.
Cool. This week's show, a court rules in favor of Apple over Samsung and a landmark patent and design lawsuit to the tune of $1 billion. We'll discuss how this affects Apple, Samsung, the whole mobile phone ecosystem, the future of patent lawsuits, and you, the consumer. But first, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And I'd like to talk about a game that I'm playing right now. I've played about an hour or so, so I'm just kind of dabbling into it, but it's a really fascinating game. It's called Papo e Yo. It's a puzzle fantasy title for the PS3. And this is a game that I checked out at E3. And it's one of the every time I go to E3, there's generally about two or three games out of the whole convention that for me really kind of stand out. And I remember after the convention is over. And Papo Iyo is probably in the top. In that top rung of games that really stood out for me, it takes place in the favelas of Brazil, and it involves a young boy who has to do some puzzle solving amongst the backdrop of the favelas of Brazil, and he's got this monster that he leads through these puzzles. And it's inspired by the personal history of child abuse experienced by the game's creator, Vander Caballero. And he's not shy about that fact. I mean, it's all over the marketing that this game came out of a background of child abuse. And the monster in the game represents his dad. You know, they say that sometimes the strongest creativity comes out of personal tragedy. And there are times playing this game that it feels like this must have been very cathartic for him to get all this out there. It won 6 awards at E3, including Best Puzzle Game, Best Adventure Game, and Best Downloadable Game. And it's available now on the PlayStation Network. So
I heard awesome things about it. I saw a review of it, I think, on Ars Technica, and I've seen a couple of references to it. It looks like a really cool game. Honestly, I'm a little bit sort of sad that this particular generation I decided to put my bets on the Wii, because it seems like all of the really cool artistic groundbreaking games have all been for the PS3.
Oh, yeah.
So.
I guess I did a good job of picking the PS3. I don't even have an Xbox 360. I just have a PS3.
Neither do I. I have the Wii and the PS3, but not the...
I do too.
Yeah, yes. The Xbox.
All right. You know what I'm feeling.
Yeah, I feel you, bro. Chris, do you have anything that you're playing with this week? You said you were playing a little bit with Google's two-factor authentication.
Yes, I am playing around with some new things this week, but I can't exactly have as rousing of a review of it as as you have. So I think we covered a few weeks ago the blogger who had his basically entire life hacked. And despite the fact that he had pretty – actually, it wasn't even his fault. He actually had very secure – and his passwords were actually never even compromised. It was actually a social engineering hack done on Apple and Google and Amazon, I think. Some combination of all those basically used to entirely take over his life. And so there's been a lot of interest in the news lately about two-factor authentication on Facebook and various other services. And I take myself my security fairly seriously and used like LastPass and a number of other options. So I decided to go with Google's two-factor authentication because that's sort of the linchpin of, you know, most people's online identities. And I wanted to see how it worked. And it's a pain, to put it shortly. I hate to say it. I'm a Linux user, and that sort of shows you how big of a pain threshold I have. But I mean, so by and large, it works fine. Like anything that supports the two-factor authentication is pretty much fine. You go to, say, a Google application on your phone or a Google website, and you enter in your email address and your regular password, and then it sends you a text message with a little code, and then you enter it in and you're fine. But it really sort of breaks down because Google has this just whole ecosystem of sort of third parties that you connect in with Google, and many of which have not implemented two-factor authentication yet or don't have the means to or whatever. And for those applications, Google has this handy-dandy thing called a temporary or application-specific password, which is a password that Google generates that you enter in as your password instead of your regular password, which logs you in with that account, which is great in theory, except the actual link to generate this is buried under settings, my account, two-factor authentication, application-specific passwords. And even if you go bookmark the site, it's still a pain to get to. And unfortunately, even things like – so I'm using Google Chrome right now, or I have Chromium actually on my computer. And Chromium doesn't work with the two-factor authentication, so you have to make an application-specific password with that. And I don't know. I've just found the whole process to be somewhat buggy and I don't know. I'm a pretty savvy computer user. I'm just imagining my parents using this and or the professors that I used to support back when I was doing IT work, and it just sounds like a nightmare. I mean, certainly I think something needs to be done to sort of overcome the over-reliance on user-generated passwords that we have. I mean, really we're sort of getting to this point where there are so many passwords that people need to remember – and users are generally not very good at generating passwords. And honestly, GPU technology is at a place where passwords that were fairly secure, say, 10 years ago are a joke now. So something needs to be done, but I think that this really needs to be worked on if it's going to be a mainstream solution. 'Cause I don't know. I'm not sure how long I'm going to handle it.
This is a pretty pressing problem. So my guess is that a lot of people are working on this right now, right? I mean, it's in the public consciousness and people care about it. So my guess is that people are working on these solutions and they're probably working very quickly to do so.
Yeah, because it's always the company that ends up looking bad, even if it's the person had a bad password. It ends up reflecting badly on the company that was hacked.
I think you've got more tolerance than I do because I had Google two-factor authentication on for about 2 days and then I ditched it. I probably shouldn't say that if someone's interested in hacking my account, but yeah, no, I couldn't withstand it for more than 2 days. And it seems like there should be a simpler solution for this. And it seems like especially coming from Google, that they've got this huge brain trust, and they can create driverless cars for God's sakes, and they should be able to tackle something as easy as two-step authentication.
Yeah, Well, unfortunately, two-factor authentication is a much more of a user experience issue than it is an engineering issue. And I wonder if I don't know, other than Google's brilliant homepage, they've never exactly been known for a sort of brilliant user experience or user interaction design. And I think this is one of their weak points. So I don't know. We'll see how they do.
Sean, what are you playing with this week?
There is an iPhone and Android and Facebook very casual game, so nothing like the game described earlier. But it's called Song Pop, Song P-O-P. Mm-hmm. And it is basically an you play against another person directly, and you're both trying to guess a song, who can guess it the fastest. And you do a set of five songs per round. And they're all different kinds of genres that you can choose from. So, for example, one of my favorites is 90s alternative. Mm-hmm. Or, I don't know. I guess I really like the ultimate 90s or ultimate 2000s. These are, when I was growing up and really know this stuff. So, right. But the idea is that it is very competitive and very addictive. So you go back and forth with rounds with people. You finish a round and you start a round with each time that it prompts you on your phone, mm-hmm. or on Facebook, you basically get to start a new round with whatever genre you want. And it's very addictive and very fun. And I highly recommend it. Just don't get so addicted that you stop working. I don't know.
is that yes. a potential possibility?
I mean, I don't know. If you get a lot of rounds going and people are really into it, that can go back and forth all day. I mean, it's kind of like, I don't know. Did you guys do Words with Friends for a while?
Yeah.
I've done the Scrabble.
With Scrabble, did you kind of get addicted and you just want to keep playing? And it can consume your time, really. Like, it's mm-hmm. very easy to mm-hmm. consume your time. So I don't know. It's a very fun game. I highly recommend giving it a shot. I don't know. Just give it a shot.
I am gonna give it a shot. Yeah, it says it's available
for the
iPad.
If you like music, if you think you have a little bit of musical knowledge, and you can select genres, it's very, very fun.
Sounds a little bit like Name That Tune.
Song Pop is the name? Okay, cool.
Yep.
Cool.
Check it out.
All right. Let's get into some headlines here. Okay, so last week we talked about recent changes to Twitter's API that restricted usage from third-party developers. According to the Next Web, the enormous blogging platform Tumblr appears to have become the next property after Instagram to have its friend-finding privileges revoked. As with Instagram, the change does not seem to have affected sharing outwards, but will impede users' ability to follow friends that they may know from Twitter. This is part of Twitter turning the screws on sharing information about the users of its network out to other services like Instagram, and by extension Facebook, and Tumblr. Tumblr has confirmed the removal and says that it's disappointed by Twitter's decision to make them remove the feature, despite being one of its partners for the new Twitter Cards features. Twitter has also removed the ability for users to determine exactly what client was used to post a message to its service from the web client. This was previously removed from its official iPhone client, and the change has been removed from the web version as well. This emphasizes Twitter's move towards controlling the reading experience of the service and pushing users towards first-party clients rather than outside apps like Twitterific and Tweetbot. So Twitter is really doing this sort of, they're raising up the walls on their garden, starting to lock everybody out, and it's really kind of pissing off a lot of third party developers. We talked a little bit about it this week, but these two latest examples of this are really, really showing Twitter's colors.
There's another instance that happened just recently. There's a service called T-Wheel, which is this really innovative iPhone application that completely messes up what you know, Twitter looks like, and it processes Twitter in a completely different way. And they just got blocked. Their API just got blocked, so they're limited to 100,000 users tops. Otherwise, it won't work. So now they were like, oh, well, we'll do this with 100,000 or whatever, and which is completely unsustainable. You can't run a business on that in our world. So, you know, anyway, they're really clamping down, and I honestly don't like it. I don't like this idea that they started and they became so popular on the backs of really good third-party clients, and now they're like, we bought a few, we'll take control, and then we're going to completely destroy everything else. It's going to be go away completely.
Yeah, I agree. If I can be so bold, I sort of predict that this is the beginning of what we might say that Twitter had jumped the shark.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not as much because I think that Twitter can get by without third-party developers to some extent for some period of time, especially if it enables them to increase their revenues. And I certainly think it'll really hurt them in terms of basically building any sort of revenue, like basically going forward. Facebook built a developer platform. Facebook hasn't really been exactly the greatest in this either. But the real reason why I think this is a really dangerous move for Twitter is because by trying to become much more of a walled garden, by trying to control this user experience much more within themselves, by trying to focus on every aspect of the way that the ads and content is displayed in it, it feels like they're basically trying to attack Facebook head on. Like they're basically saying Twitter is going to be like Facebook, except slightly different. And I really feel like that is a strategy which is always going to define you as second best, just in the same way that Burger King is forever trying to be McDonald's and never overtaking them.
Now third place.
Yeah, exactly. Trying to define yourself as a different version of an existing entrenched player is a way that's going to permanently define you in relation to that player. And Twitter really had an opportunity to be a really drastically different type of social network with a drastically different monetization model from Facebook's, purely just display ads or now in-stream type advertising. And they had the opportunity to really do a lot more with it, but they basically said, no, we're going to do ads and we're going to do them the same way that everyone else does them. And we're going to, sort of lock down everything. And now they just feel to me like a Facebook that doesn't quite have as many people or as many features or as many options on the platform. And now you can't even connect with people on there, which is really weird because that's one thing that Facebook seems to have always been able to do is connect with people on Facebook. That's sort of the whole point of it. I don't know. I think it's a really dangerous move for them.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I was going to say this is really a make or break time. I mean, people are either going to move en masse away from Twitter, or Twitter is going to be able to ride out this wave of bad will that they're facing from the third party developers.
Where would people go? I mean, the people who use Twitter now. I mean, especially tech folks like ourselves. Yeah. And there's a lot of celebrities and people like to follow, they're not like us. You know what I mean? Like they're just very casual follow, I follow my 20 people and that's what I use Twitter for. So, I mean, maybe we're overreacting. Is that possible that we just, we're blowing this out of proportion?
Mm-hmm. It's possible. My question is just to play devil's advocate, Twitter is doing this because they need to generate revenue. What would they do if they weren't doing this to generate revenue? They're kind of backed into a corner into doing something like this.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, they certainly. That's why I sort of discount a little bit the developer. The developers being that important. I don't know. I guess the thing that a lot of people realize is I don't understand how this ends up being such. I feel like there's two there. First of all, there's the fact that for a lot of the way that people use Twitter itself is insufficient. the whole ecosystem of applications that have grown up around the Twitter power users. Hootsuite and TweetDeck and you know, some of these other sort of analytics and whatnot. And those actually address the very power users that generate all that value for Twitter. I mean, those are the massive companies and the celebrities and whatnot that, you know, have actual staff members managing their Twitter accounts. So, like, Twitter needs to actually provide an alternative to do the things that people are currently using Twitter to do to build that value. And right now, that's been the third-party developers. So it's somewhat worrisome to see third-party developers not doing much or being sort of shut out, because that's where so much of the power came from.
Perhaps the power is now is the fact that they have 200 million actives, I think, and that is enough to monetize. So now we're going to deliver in the stream, and we're going to make sure that no one is going to get in the way of you getting a promoted tweet. And that's the key, is that every single one of their users need to get those promoted tweets, so we make money on that. And we've been private for a long time. We're not a public company. We've been private, and we have all these people. We need to make money. So the devil's advocate position is they have to do this to make money, right?
I think we're probably going to see more of this from Twitter, not less. So
they had to follow Facebook's example. I'm guessing that they had to, because otherwise it just goes. How many more years can Twitter survive without actually making sizable revenue?
Right. That's true. I mean, but there are other ways. There are other ways they could have monetized. Like I've talked about this for years about Twitter's potential monetization, and one of the ideas that I had come up with, which I'm sure I'm not the one that came up with it, but just out of speculation, was that they would sell, you know, part of their API. You know, they'd have different levels of access to their API, and the full fire hose of their entire API would be, they could sell it at a premium for businesses or whoever wanted it. Also, they could sell analytics based on data that they are accumulating from their users. There's a number of different ways that they could monetize.
Yeah, that was always my imagination, and that's, I think, one thing that's really frustrating to developers. I mean, I think a lot of developers sort of thought, or at least I always assumed, that Twitter was at some point going to, you know, charge for API access. I mean, early on, you know, they had some of their early deals with Google and with Facebook. I think it was primarily with Google and Bing, sorry, to access the firehose and index it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, goodness, that sounds awesome. Like, make a true on access for the super high powered, you know, analytics and whatnot that people want off of Twitter. That seems where a lot of the value of Twitter was right, in the analytics, in the just straight up advertising is kind of odd, because so much of Twitter is already advertising. Yeah. And that's sort of part of the
ain't that the truth?
Yeah. I mean, I think the primary reason why they're not going down on a lot of this stuff is because they want to be able to analyze what happened. I mean, part of the big value of web-based advertising has been the ability to give feedback. You're not just sending off an ad and going it off into the blue. And I think they're really worried that if they start embedding ads into the stream, then third-party clients are going to quickly be like, oh, well, that's an ad and that's an ad, and I just remove it. But I don't know. I'm just glad I don't have a business built on top of Twitter right now.
Yeah. All right, let's move on here. Seattle Times reports that for the first time in 25 years, Microsoft is changing their corporate logo. Microsoft, which has used its solid, bold-faced, italicized logo since 1987, is expected to unveil its new, more colorful logo Thursday. It's coming at a time, or by the time you hear this podcast, it will have unveiled it already. It's coming at a time when the company is preparing to launch new or significantly updated versions of nearly every one of its products, from Windows to Windows Phone to Office. The new logo features the name Microsoft in the Sego font, a font Microsoft owns and has used in its products and marketing for several years. The F and the T in the name Microsoft are connected in the new logo just as they were in the old. For the first time, the company's logo will also include a symbol, in this case, a square formed by four multicolor square tiles reminiscent of the company's multi-hued Windows logos in years past, which is ironic because the Windows 8 logo is a single color logo. The colors in the squares, blue, orange, green, and yellow, are those long associated with Microsoft. So there we go. Microsoft's got a new logo. You know, it's about time, I guess.
Yeah, I like the new logo. It's nice. I really, really resonate with the designer who sort of helped them redesign the Windows logo, which is sort of now part of the main logo, which is, if it's a window, why is it a flag? Like,
right.
The waving window has always been like sort of weird to me. And I really like the sort of more straight, geometric design. And I really like the new font. Did you guys look at some of the old Windows logos or Microsoft logos?
I did. Yeah. In that article that's attached there, the Seattle Times article, they showed like the rundown of all the past old Microsoft logos. And they're ones that are like, you know, you could tell that they were just basically, this is going to be the logo because everybody is doing this a logo like this, like that first logo, the 75-79 one.
Yeah, with the sort of circles in it and everything.
Yeah.
I really like the metal logo. Like their second one, they only had it for like a few months and seriously looks like Metallica. Just like Microsoft's brief metal phase.
Doesn't it look like the same font as like Rock Band?
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder if that one just came off as too harsh for the company, and they decided to go with that other, with the next one in the loop.
Well, sure, they were just all listening to like really heavy metal at the time. They're like, "Yeah, we're awesome," and they're like, "Wait a minute, this isn't professional."
They learned. So yes. Sad.
So there we go.
I think the new logo is kind of bland. I honestly am not huge on the new Windows logo, but I think this one is better. It's very general. Honestly, you know, they needed to change, and this goes with I'm going to just say Metro because I don't know what else to call it.
Uh-huh.
Metro interface that they've since gotten rid of that Metro word because of trademark disputes, which is so frustrating because they've been calling it for 2 years and we've all been calling it that.
They should have done some research into that name before. Doesn't it seem like short-sighted on their part?
Anyway, so the Metro, not Metro UI that a lot of their products have now, it works really well with that. And it's clean. It looks friendly. It's nice. I think they could have done better, but it's much better than the old one. So,
have you guys gotten a chance to play around with Windows 8?
I've spent a lot of time.
Really?
Yeah, I've been running.
I guess we probably should. That's a whole discussion in and of itself.
Discussion. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, when it officially comes out, because I have not played with the release, release master, whatever they call it, the RTM.
Mm-hmm.
I have not played with that final release to marketing, release to master version, but I've been playing with the consumer release for a while now as a dual boot on my MacBook Air, and that's a whole ball of cats in itself of problems because it was never meant to be on a Mac. And I think it seems to me like the ideal platform for Windows 8 is a tablet computer, but certainly not.
That's my thought exactly. I actually can give my thoughts on Windows 8 pretty quickly. For tablets, love it. Ultrabooks, okay. And desktops, fan. So that's where I stand. It's great for tablets, not great for desktops. Ultrabooks with really interesting gestures, it can do some interesting stuff, but you have to have the right gestures and know what you're doing. But anyway, that's a whole nother conversation. It's a whole bag of worms. I wrote an article recently called Windows 8 is terrible for desktops, and I got so many negative comments on it. It's so – people were so angry.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
I didn't know there were so many Windows, like Windows 8 lovers already. And it was just, they were so angry.
Did you get a chance to study it actually on the Windows Surface or one of the Windows tablets?
No. I haven't played with it on the Surface. I've played with it on a Samsung developer tablet, and I liked it a lot.
Okay.
I liked it a lot on that on the tablet.
Okay, cool. Because I remember reading I think Ars Technica had an article on basically whether or not Windows 8 works as a tablet computer, and I was sort of surprised at how, I mean, at least their reaction seemed to be, it's okay as a tablet computer. That's the only opinion I've seen on it, so I'm curious sort of other views on how it functions as a tablet computer.
I think it's great, because what you're getting is you're getting the majority, okay, so I really like Windows 7, and you get a lot of that functionality, right, in Windows 8. And so when you suddenly have to figure out how to make that work on tablets, it wasn't that you knew you wanted Windows 7 on a tablet. You wanted something that was more functional on a tablet. And so here I'm getting some of that Microsoft core experience, but I'm getting it in a new way. And with my finger, it's so much easier to do everything. But when you're doing it with a mouse, or if you're doing it with gestures, it's a little harder, and it takes more steps. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That's all. It's a whole bag of worms. We should really have a long discussion about Windows 8.
Well, when they do finally launch it, I'd love to have you back on the show, and we'll launch right into a full discussion on that.
Sure, that'd be great.
Okay, so moving on here, Apple's long-awaited foray into television devices will have to wait a bit longer, according to a report by Pacific Crest analyst Andy Hargraves. Eddie Q, Apple's senior vice president of Internet Software and Services, reiterated the company's mantra that it will enter markets where it feels it can create great customer experiences and address key problems. While Apple could almost certainly create a better user interface, Mr. Q suggested that this would be an incomplete solution from Apple's perspective unless it could deliver content in a way that is different from the current multi-channel pay TV model. So it sounds like it's going to be a little while before we see the Apple TV or the iTV, whatever Apple chooses to call it. You know, I thought the idea would have been that for a set-top box, or essentially maybe, you know, new firmware for Apple TV that will make it essentially like the idea would be like to have some sort of iPad or iPhone interface where you can order channels a la carte the way you would download apps for those portable devices. That was kind of the idea that at least I had simmering in.
I think a lot of people have had that idea. The unfortunate part is that the content providers are not having it. They're like, no, you can't. We need people to buy this in a bundle, and we're going to make it stay that way. This is why HBO will not put their content on the internet for HBO Go just a la carte. They want you to buy it on you know, in part of your cable package, because they make way more money that way. So
yeah, I think honestly what really needs to happen is basically somebody, like, and this sounds crazy, but basically we need like startup studios that actually have, you know, there's some, you know, groups out there that have managed to do pretty well with sort of online production. I'm thinking like Rooster Teeth that did Red vs. Blue and a few other online ones, but it's really hard to hit a mass market online, and it's really hard to hit the sort of production values and name recognition and everything that drives, you know, TV. I don't know. It's a huge, huge, huge chicken and egg problem, if ever there was one.
Well, I mean, there are certainly providers like Netflix and Amazon. Amazon's online content delivery that you know, Apple has already worked with people like that, and they could, they could start with companies like those as far as developing these content deals and build relationships with companies like those, and eventually they have they'll have this kind of juggernaut of cachet of, you know, we've got all of this, all of these small names, and now they can attack the bigger names like the cable networks or the major networks.
Let me ask you guys some questions about Apple. What is Apple's number one revenue generator? Number one.
The iPhone, I believe.
Correct. And let me ask you this. How much revenue do you think iTunes, all the iTunes sales of media, of like movies and TV and music, how much revenue in the scheme of things, what percentage of Apple's revenue comes from iTunes media sales? What would you guess?
I'm going to say 60%.
Total? Wait, total revenues come 60% from iTunes?
No.
No, is that what you're saying, Andy?
Yeah, that's my guess. It could be incredibly.
I would guess more like less than 10%, given that I'm a very heavy app buyer.
Less than 10%. So it's like content is not a big moneymaker for Apple. Apple's money comes from hardware sales. So if Apple wants to deliver, you know, a new Apple TV, it has to have good margins and it has to have a good business model. So I don't know. I don't see it happening unless there is a dramatically new business model for them to do it. You'd have to only be able to get it on Apple TV. Like, the content providers will only do it on Apple TV. And it's like, why would they want to make that kind of deal? It's a terrible deal for them. They make way more money when you're doing cable packages. Right?
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's a really tough situation. Apple could potentially revolutionize how we consume TV. It's just that I don't think anyone wants to play ball.
Yeah. And we've already seen some of that that sort of reaction from Google TV's foray into trying to get content providers to join with them. So I can definitely see how it would be a challenge for Apple. But
it's cool, but do you guys own a Google TV?
No. Devendra does.
Yeah, I know, but he's like, but what guy? Don't. Right.
Even my Google friends out here don't own a Google TV. I don't think
there
I
There you go. It just even when the tech enthusiasts aren't buying, it's like, what happens
when the Google employees aren't buying? I know one of them has a Nexus, but I don't think he uses it because no one has any idea what a Nexus is. It's a $600 paperweight.
I think that
is actually not. It's actually gone back to being redesigned and stuff right now.
Okay, so it's not around the Nexus Q. The Nexus circle Q. Thingy. Right. Well, I'm glad that they're doing something with that because. Yeah.
It was a terrible idea, but
I'm not sure if it was an idea at all. It was pretty much just like, let's build a circular thing that'll have electronics in it. That'll do stuff.
It doesn't really do anything that you can't already do in online or in other forms of, you know, it's a redundant solution for a non-existent problem.
Can I ask you guys another question about Apple? Not a trick question or anything. Okay, so what do you think about this? What if Apple released a 27-inch television with all kinds of cool Apple software and apps on the television? But you'd still have to subscribe to cable like normal if you wanted to get all your channels and stuff and have a cable set-top box. But maybe this television, you know, has all kinds of awesome Apple software on it. Would you guys be interested in that? Could that be something that Apple could sell?
I mean, I think for me, the problem is I really don't need another television, and it would have to be. And Apple's entering into a market that is already better served by other electronics companies like Samsung or, you know, a million other TV manufacturers. What I really want is something like a set-top box. You know, I want the Apple experience.
Apple TV little thing, you know, it's tiny and It is a set-top box. It does give you access to lots of content from the web. I mean, what about just to keep improving that? Just keep making it better.
That would be good. I honestly would be interested in a Apple branded TV. I don't know if I'd be able to afford it, given how expensive their big monitors are. But I will say, and I don't know if Apple considers this to be worth their while, but I even still, the interfaces on TVs are terrible. I mean, even the new awesome, you know, high end TVs, you know, beautiful pictures and everything. But you know, I pick up the remote and I'm just like, okay, which one is the volume? And it's like, oh, the volume's not connected to that volume. It's a really messy situation. And I don't know. That would they could definitely potentially, and if they put they a bunch of integration with it, there's possibilities. I'd be intrigued.
But they could use Siri for their interface, or the Siri could voice assistant could help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I like that
Siri,
idea.
The 322, boom. Hmm. I don't know.
All right, let's move on here. A federal court in Massachusetts this week upheld a $675,000 damages award against Joel Tenenbaum, who was accused of illegally downloading 31 songs from a file-sharing website and distributing them, and was sued by the main recording companies in the U.S. The U.S. District Court judge rejected Tenenbaum's request for a new jury trial, saying jurors had appropriately considered the evidence of Tenenbaum's actions, downloading and distributing files for 2 years despite warnings and harm to the plaintiffs. The penalty is at the low end of the range for willful infringement and below the limit for even non-willful infringement, and thus was not excessive, the judge ruled. We're pleased with the district court's decision, was the comment from the RIAA. And I bring this up because we've spoken about this before on the Drill Down with previous hosts, but this is the first time I think that we've talked about an issue like this with our current panel. And I wanted to ask what you felt about the in cases like this, do you feel like the punitive damages, that the punishment fits the crime?
I mean, I would say absolutely not. The $675,000 penalty is going to ruin somebody's life. This kid, he was in college when he did this, mind you. We all made mistakes in college. I mean, I'm assuming. And he the thing is, okay, he deserves to be fined for this because he got repeated warnings and kept doing it.
Sure.
He got a cease and desist letter from like Sony. It was not only did he get warnings, he got an official like legal cease and desist to stop it. And he still kept doing it. So it was like, dude, you can't do this. So maybe he should be fined, I don't know, $50,000 or something like that for being such a doofus. But $675,000. And now the court has upheld this and it will not go to the Supreme Court. It's done. This guy, there's no more legal proceedings. He owes $675,000. It's like, are you kidding me? 31 songs?
Yeah.
How is that worth? You know, he was distributing too, right? It's not just that he downloaded it. It's that he distributed those as well over the network because he kept it active. Yeah. So it's I think it's completely absurd. Chris, what do you
think? Well, it's kind of particularly – I almost want to put it like tragic, because it seems like the RAA has basically given up this strategy. So you can't even say that it's part of like a broader like strategy of showing that piracy will get you sued, because we know that they don't do this sort of lawsuit anymore. So, I mean, I guess it's nice for them that they won this lawsuit, but it's not even like part of an overall, you know, strategy on this. And, you know, there are probably kids today who are still downloading stuff illegally off of, you know, whatever sites they use for it. Yeah, I know. I've always been in a weird position on the copyright thing, because I don't think that the sort of protections we have in place are right, that basically there's entirely too much value or protection that's put on the content owner, and that the content users and even content creators generally end up getting left out of the picture on that. But at the same time, $600,000 just seems absolutely ridiculous, especially at that age in life. I mean, I'm sort of just curious in the logistics of like, okay, well, once they've taken, you know, the few thousand he has in his bank account, what do you do then?
Right.
Like,
how does your wage for the rest of your life, basically? I'm going to take a cut of your paycheck for the entirety of the rest of your life. It'll never get paid back, but we'll take a good chunk of your money for the rest of your life. Good luck with everything.
That's like a student loan, but in that you never you're not getting an education. The education that you're getting out of that is don't download illegal stuff off the internet. And you can't take that education.
Less money, so it's like it's more incentive to find ways to download off the internet. So I don't know. The whole system is I don't like the system. I don't like the idea that a song can be like at a single song. I think Instance was worth. It was upwards of, I feel like, $100,000 or something. I was just completely absurd. It was like, guys, the music, a single song is not actually worth that much.
Just kind of, if it was $600,000, that would be about $20,000 per song. Yeah.
Yeah, that was not they didn't go to the max. They did the lower end of the penalties.
Yeah, that was the low end of the penalties. He got off easy, in other words.
Indeed.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, moving on here. IAC, a holding company headed by former Paramount and Fox exec Barry Diller, which owns over 50 brands such as Ask.com, Match.com, Vimeo, College Humor, OkCupid, and more, has agreed to purchase About.com from the New York Times for $300 million. TechCrunch says that while About.com is pretty good, the traffic at the site ain't what it used to be. In the last quarter, ad revenues were down nearly 9% to $25 million. Operating costs were up by some 15%, and the site had an operating loss of $187 million. But if About.com's declining traffic seems to make the site less and less a good fit for the New York Times, it makes it more sense to have a home at IAC, which already has a number of properties that function as, on a similar business model. IAC can potentially pool its resources together to bring down some costs on the site, and About.com would become another outlet for the advertising network that runs across the rest of the IAC portfolio. So this, I mean, when I first heard the news about them purchasing About.com, I wondered why anyone would want to buy that site, because it's kind of the old guard of internet sites, but it seems to me that this IAC company, that's their stock in trade, is buying all these smaller sites that are kind of obsolete and then continuing to serve ads on them. So I guess it makes sense from that perspective.
My initial response to this was S.com has $300 million in cash that they can give to somebody. Like, where did that come from?
Yeah, but IAC is a huge, huge company. Yeah. That it just, yeah. Ask.com is one little tiny piece of IAC. So, OkCupid, Vimeo, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah. No, they own a big. I was actually kind of sad also because I've always sort of had a little spot for About.com. I used them way back in the day when they were one of the few sort of general purpose content sites out there. And I would say, I hate to say it, but they are essentially a content farm. Mm-hmm. But I would say of the content farms, they're by far the highest quality in terms of links and whatnot. And I don't know. I hope that they can stay around for a little bit, because I certainly would prefer them to, what is it, Demand Media or Squidoo or any of those type of sites.
Well, if you look, it's funny. If you look at IAC's holdings, like a lot of their, I would say, I mean, a lot of their... I have a feeling that About.com is going to be around for a while, because all of these other sites are still around. They're holding on to sites that are just, I didn't even know they still existed, but you got like Excite.com.
Oh, it's still around?
Yes. Zwinky, and I don't know anyone who ever went to Zwinky. but lots of tiny little sites like that. Urban Spoon. They had,
dude, come on, dictionary.com, thesaurus.com, yeah. Vimeo, Urban Spoon, what else? OkCupid, Ask.com. No, these are City Search, College Humor. Mm-hmm. These are big. They're big. I mean, they own a bunch of tiny stuff that nobody goes to anymore. But they're like, why not?
I still use thesaurus.com on a regular basis.
I do too, actually. Yeah.
Like almost every day.
I don't think I use it every day, but I mean, you know, sometimes I'm just like, what is that? What is that word? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Okay, moving on here. Oh, okay, so our last headline before we get into our main topic. So Reddit's AMA, Ask Me Anything, is a forum for all kinds of people to offer themselves as a sounding board for the many questions people may have about their situation. A number of celebrities including Bill Nye, the Science Guy, comedian Louis C.K., and actor Zach Braff have all participated, but they've all been trumped today. So to speak, by the latest Ask Me Anything guest, which is President Barack Obama, who decided to pop in on Reddit and do his own AMA. He answered about, I'd say, about 10 questions, give or take, and they were all fairly softball questions. He got to choose the questions that he answered and choose the questions that he chose not to answer. And all of them were fairly softball questions, and they were all, his answers were all felt kind of like stump speeches in a way. But I mean, I think that's just keeping on message with his upcoming reelection campaign. Did you guys check out the president's Ask Me Anything?
Well, he took down the site, which I guess is not really unsurprising for Reddit. I read through some of it on a cached version of the site, and I don't know. It's mostly just sort of campaign talking. I wasn't really expecting any sort of like deep revelation, sort of watermark moment. But I think it does sort of represent a watermark in terms of elections, where interacting with constituents online is now an integral part of the campaign. Certainly, and something which I think is honestly a good strategic move for him, because Reddit is mostly going to be younger and probably more liberal voters of the type that would probably be for Obama but may not necessarily vote for him. So reaching out to them via their medium, I think, would be a great way to probably get more people who support him to actually vote for him. Which is probably going to be one of the biggest sort of points that this election hinges on.
I mean, I don't think that he answered the questions, you know, terribly, yeah. Like, awesome. It's just that they were incredibly on point. Yeah. He's not going to say anything controversial because he's trying. The election is coming up. It's right. Super soon. It's only, two to three months away, and it's like, now is not the time to be like, yeah, we should reform the marijuana or something. Like, this isn't the time to do that. That's if you get reelected, then you can do that. But you're right. It's a good chance to reach out to young liberal voters. And Reddit has enormous numbers of readership. He got tons of great press today from the tech press. And it's good counter programming for the GOP convention happening right now. Yes.
Right. I didn't think about that. Yeah, nice pull. So,
yes.
Okay.
Anyway.
So, before we get into our hot topic here, I want to talk a little bit about our sponsor. Our sponsor is Audible.com. And for the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to talk about this week is called 14, and it's by an author named Peter Kleins. And I honestly know nothing about this book, but when I was perusing the Audible catalog, I sorted by most popular in the in science fiction and fantasy, and this was the top current, like, most popular book on there. So I thought, well, let's first thing I did was use one of my Audible credits and bought it, and then decided that I was gonna talk a little bit about it. So just in a nutshell, here's kind of the nutshell synopsis. Padlocked doors, strange light fixtures, mutant cockroaches. There are some odd things about Nate's new apartment, but while his new home isn't perfect, it's livable. The rent is low, the property managers are friendly, and the odd little mysteries don't nag him too much. At least not until he meets Mandy, his neighbor, across the hall, and notices something unusual about her apartment, and Zella's apartment, and Tim's, and Veek's, because every room in this old Los Angeles brownstone has a mystery or two. Mysteries that stretch back over 100 years. Some of them are in plain sight, some behind locked doors, and altogether these mysteries could mean the end of Nate and his friends, or the end of everything. One of the critics has compared this to, he says, it's a riveting apocalyptic mystery in the style of Lost, which is really all you need to say for me to want to read this book. So this book is narrated by Ray Porter, and that book, or any of Audible's other 100,000-plus titles, can be yours, plus a 30-day trial to check out their service. And all you need to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Use that that URL, because that actually helps our show out a bit. And if you've never subscribed to Audible, it's a great chance to get a free book and check out their service. If you don't like the service at all, you get to keep the free book. And once again, it helps our show out, and it's a great service. I've been using Audible for a while. All right, so we're going to take a little break here and play some music. But when we come back, we're going to talk about a legal victory that just might change how all future mobile devices are designed. So take a listen to this and come on back. You think we look pretty good together? You think my shoes are made? If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and social media and how it affects us. I'm here with Christopher Bernor and Sean Ludwig, and this week we're talking about Apple versus Samsung. In a verdict that would have warmed the heart of late Apple CEO Steve Jobs, a federal jury last Friday handed Apple a resounding legal victory in its bitter patent war with Samsung, ordering the South Korean tech giant to pay more than $1 billion. And you could say that with a little pinky to your mouth, if you like, a la Dr. Evil, in damages for willfully copying the iPhone and the iPad. Legal experts say the jury's finding of willful infringement enables Apple to seek triple the $1 billion damage award, already believed to be an unprecedented judgment in a patent trial. The verdict also sends a threatening message to Samsung and other Apple competitors in the mobile phone and tablet industry that use Google's Android operating system, potentially making it harder for them to compete with Apple. One bit of good news for Samsung: the jurors found that the Galaxy Tab 10.1 tablet did not infringe on any physical iPad design patents, as Apple had claimed. Following Apple's big win in court, Apple CEO Tim Cook sent a memo, a response to Apple's corporate employees. He said, "Today is an important day for Apple and for innovators everywhere. Many of you have been following closely the trial against Samsung. We chose legal action very reluctantly and only after repeatedly asking Samsung to stop copying our work. For us, this lawsuit has always been about something more, much more important than patents or money. It's about values. We value originality and innovation and pour our lives into making the best products on earth. And we do this to delight of our customers, not for our competitors to flagrantly copy. The jury has now spoken. We applaud them for finding Samsung's behavior willful and for sending a loud and clear message that stealing isn't right. I'm very proud of the work each of you do today. Values have won, and I hope the whole world listens. Signed, Tim. Sean, I'm going to turn to you first because this is a part of your beat on VentureBeat. What did you think about the outcome of the trial?
I guess the thing was, is, all right, really the point of the jury, you know, they were supposed to decide who could make a more convincing argument, mm-hmm. right? Apple needed to present its evidence. Samsung had presented counter evidence. And the Apple did a very, very good job of making the case that Samsung copied them. And there are so many documents out there where it's like there are people from Samsung that were directing their employees, yeah, we're going to make it look like this. And these are in like memos and stuff. It's like you can't, you know, if this is showing it to be willful.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically Apple did a very good job of making the case to the jury, so much that I think it was the first day of testimony or something like that, that they had already decided that Apple, you know, basically was the side they were going with. So they did a good job, and they should be commended for their legal prowess and spanking Samsung. I mean, okay, here's the thing, is I actually – I find the idea that you're suing Samsung for copying to be incredibly hypocritical on Apple's part, considering – part of Apple's very success hinged on them stealing the graphical user interface from Xerox, right?
Right.
Isn't that the beginning, one of the origins?
That's
of
the
Apple
common argument.
Is based on stealing. and Steve Jobs liked to steal good ideas. That was part of what they did anyway. So the idea that they were getting so up in arms with Samsung over this, it's just like, it's kind of absurd, but I think Steve Jobs initially, when this all really started, he hated Android, right? He just hated it. He did not like the idea that Android took a lot of ideas from what was already out there from the iPhone. He did not like it. He said to his biographer that he was going to do thermonuclear war.
Right?
He was so angry.
Yeah. Which so, pretty much anyway. Kills the whole this has always been about whatever it was that he said it was about. Because we know it was always about thermonuclear from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it wasn't about values. It was about Steve Jobs being angry. So anyway, you know what? Apple did a very good job of presenting its case. You know what? I'm actually convinced. The evidence that they put forth, I found it convincing that Samsung copied aspects of what Apple had already done.
Yeah.
I found it convincing. This is why the Galaxy S3 is very different from the Galaxy S2 and the Galaxy S1. It is a very different kind of phone. It has its own kind of style and design and interface. It really feels much more original, doesn't it?
But let me ask you a question here. Like, fundamentally, isn't the whole idea of suing a company for copying their design, isn't it kind of hypocritical? Because technological design, any design, is influenced by other previous previous designs. Design is an evolution. You can almost argue that there's no design out there that evolved in a complete vacuum without any sort of influence from previous designs. Isn't the evolution of design based on other designs necessary in the marketplace?
That's been my issue with this thing. Oh, so you go first. Sorry.
No. I was going to say, except you've got to add the component of patents into the mix.
Right.
So it's it's not just about that, you know, they were angry about design. It's also about having legitimate patents on a lot of the stuff that gets thrown around. So I don't know. Chris, what were you going to say?
Well, I mean, I'm in agreement with you. I don't think there really was much of a question that their phones were essentially copies of the iPhone on some level. I mean, the Android clearly was heavily influenced by Apple, clearly was, you know, took many of the design features from Apple. Samsung, as one of the leading Android manufacturers, clearly was doing, you know, very heavy sort of, you know, connect or copying of Apple. I mean, I guess what many people in the tech industry, myself included, sort of hoped is that this would be sort of like the with the Java patent lawsuit, that this would be a limitation on what could and could not be patented. I mean, because many of these patents were design patents. They were patents on specific aspects of a design of a user interface. They weren't even necessarily on like algorithms or the implementation of the technology of the phone. They were patents for things like bouncing when you get to the top. And I mean, and my problem was just, I was like, well, yeah, of course Samsung copied. So what? I mean, if Delicious had been able to patent the Ajax technology that they were able to use with their bookmarking site back in the day so that no one else could use it, the web would be nothing. If every single, you know, site operator or mobile operator had to come up with an entirely new interface language. I mean, that's one of the things about interfaces is that people need to be able to sit down at some sort of computing device or honestly any device and figure out easily how it works. Like, you need to be able to sit down and intuitively understand, which means that manufacturers not just should be able to copy each other, they need to be able to copy each other. You need to be able to use the design language that exists out there that people are expecting in order to make people able to use your product. I think it's really dangerous to be able to have a corner on a particular design language word, essentially, that prevents any other manufacturer from using that, because that's the way that people speak with computers. I don't know. It really, I think, is a step backwards in terms of patent law. And actually, there's been some comments from the jury foreman that he might have actually fundamentally misunderstood the concept of prior art, which was really the sort of primary thing that the PIP was about. And basically, was this something that Apple actually invented, or was this something that had been around that Apple just sort of perfected? I don't know.
It sounds like there's going to be an appeal in any case. New York, let me read a couple of things here. New York Times says that Apple defined the category in the way phones look and how users interact with them. Most popular smartphones today are a slab of glass and metal controlled through a touchscreen full of icons arrayed on the screen. Because consumers are familiar with that format, phones from various makers tended to look and behave similarly. Those similarities might be the first things to change. Companies in the future are going to have to consider how much they want their product to look and feel like their competitors' products in terms of size, shape, size, the way it feels, the way it looks, how icons are similar, or will the icons be quite dissimilar, said Robert W. Dickerson Jr., a lawyer who is head of the West Coast of a West Coast intellectual property practice. While Google is not involved in the case, Apple was clearly going after Android all along. If other handset makers using Android fear that Apple will take them on and win, might they shy away from Android? Which is a good question. And what will be the few, how is this going to affect the whole mobile phone ecosystem in general?
I don't know. That's the one of the scary things about this is that it's a really big sort of push on one of the biggest manufacturers. I mean, Samsung makes most of the Nexus phones now, or at least the last.
All right. Wait a minute. The thing is that the asserted in this case that the patents and whatever was going toward devices that are basically no longer being sold, right? Like, this case had nothing to do with the current crop of Samsung devices. So Samsung is already moved away, is starting using more original designs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I almost feel like we don't have to worry about this. You just have to make sure that your design is different enough from Apple to keep it away from your lawsuit. I don't know. I almost feel like this feels like something that make people more innovative. Like, I really like Windows Phone. I really like the interface. I like the ideas behind it. It feels wholly original. And I don't think there's any problem with pushing people who are putting these very expensive little mobile PCs in our hands to push them to be original when we sell these things. I don't know. I like the idea of choice. I like the idea of going across and being able to look at several different kinds of phones before I, make that 2-year commitment or whatever. Mm-hmm.
I want to give you a different perspective on this case. This comes from Farhad Manju at Pando Daily, who suggests that maybe Samsung didn't lose after all. He says, in the fall of 2008, just a year after it released the iPhone, Apple became the most profitable phone maker in the world. If you were a phone maker watching the iPhone's sudden rise, you had to make a quick decision. One option was to do nothing, and a lot of firms opted for this path, Nokia and RIM, for instance. Another option was to try and leapfrog Apple. This was Palm's idea, and belatedly, it's what Microsoft began to do too. And then there was the third choice. You could just copy Apple. A federal jury decided that Samsung was guilty of doing just that. It's tempting after such a sweeping verdict in Apple's favor to conclude that Samsung's decision to mimic the iPhone was a terrible mistake, since they're going to be on the hook for at least $1 billion in damages and the judge could triple that amount. But if you study what's happened in the mobile industry since 2007, a different moral emerges. It goes like this. Copying works. Yes, Samsung's copying was amateurish and panicky, and now it'll have to pay for its indiscretions. But the costs of patent infringement will fall far short of what Samsung gained by aping Apple. Over the last few years, thanks to its brilliant mimicry, Samsung became a global force in the smartphone business, and this verdict will do little to roll back that success. Faced with an emergency, a crisis of design, copying was the best Samsung could do, and it paid off handsomely. And like you said, Sean, that Samsung is moving away from those designs. You know, those are obsolete designs that were part of this injunction, and now they're moving away. So it gave them kind of the kickstart it needed to get past the being, you know, get past their slump. And now that they've built on aping Apple, they can move on to doing other designs, original designs.
You guys want to know what Samsung's net profit was last quarter?
What's that?
$4.5 billion in profit, which is like,
wow.
How much cash are they accumulating over time? You know what I mean? Like, they just stacks and stacks of mm-hmm. cash. And so, like, I think I have to agree with Farhad Manshu's idea that they copied, it worked, they made a ton of money, and now they are the single most successful Android phone manufacturer in the world. So they've done all right for themselves.
So this was this is basically like chump change, like a fine. Like a misdemeanor.
It's not chump change exactly. It does hurt the bottom line, but it won't, like, it's not like gonna critically damage them mm-hmm. or anything. It's like, sure, all right. We got hurt this quarter. Darn it.
So there you go. So good move for Samsung, if that's what they were if they were thinking that they could get away with this and take the hit, and you know it would be basically amortize the damages that they might receive by doing this over time, then that was a brilliant strategy on their part. So how is this going to affect us, the regular mobile consumer?
Probably not as much. I mean, I don't know. The one thing that gets bugged at me is people are like, oh, you know, this is any additional cost in the manufacturing is going to immediately be added on to the price of the phone, and the phones are going to be really expensive. Now, I mean, that's not how pricing of this sort of thing works. I mean, when you're pricing a product, you look not just at how much it costs to make it, but also how much does it cost to, like, how much are consumers willing to build for it? And I mean, that's consumers, how much consumers are willing to spend is not necessarily changed. I don't think it's necessarily immediately going to be passed on to consumers. My guess is, to the extent that it is passed on, it'll be much more indirect in terms of, maybe like you were saying, Sean, in terms of either leapfrogging Andy, you really want to talk about, you know, leapfrogging again or trying to do a different type of technology. I don't know.
I would say, why don't you just do really, really careful work and don't, you know, Android is really has dramatically changed. You know what I mean? Like, it's really different from where it started. And you can use Android so many ways. Like, the Kindle Fire uses Android, mm-hmm, and it feels nothing like Android. So it's, you can use Android in a lot of interesting, creative ways. You can make it so that it doesn't mimic Apple's, you know, interface, and you can still have a great product. So the Galaxy S3 is a very good product. And the Windows phone, the new Windows phones are probably going to be really awesome. The Samsung has a new Windows phone, Windows Phone 8 device they just announced today. And that's going to be coming out probably in the next month or two. So there we go. Consumer choice.
Yeah.
Now, Apple's suit with Samsung was basically an extension of a patent lawsuit with Motorola Mobility initiated while Steve Jobs was in control of the company. And now that it's over and Tim Cook's fully in charge, do you think he'll continue Jobs' legacy of aggressive patent and design suits against competitors? Do you think he's going to want to go thermonuclear with anybody else out there? Is he going to go after Android and Google next?
That is the multi-billion dollar question.
I don't know. The thing is, okay, this might sound callous or wrong-headed. I think Tim Cook might be a better businessman than Steve Jobs. Like, no, Steve Jobs mm-hmm. was brilliant, and he had a lot of incredibly good instincts and made a lot of good decisions for his company, completely turned around his company. But I think Tim Cook is like, you know what? We're going to steer the course. We're going to just keep building this incredible company. Apple has so much money right now, and they're finally paying a dividend on their shares. They are the most valuable company in the world by market cap. It's like they're doing really good business right now. They are an incredibly valuable company, and Tim Cook is like, you know what? We're gonna keep it that way. And if there's a cost benefit analysis, right? If they're gonna make a lot of money off suing people for infringing on design, they might as well do it, right? Because they want to just keep building Apple's cash, right? They want to just build the stockpile and dive into it like Scrooge McDuck, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's you're right. It's good. I think with Tim Cook, it's going to come down to much more of a business position rather than a personal tradition. Because yeah, I mean, as much as Tim Cook presumably loves Apple, it's not his baby in the same way that it was Jobs' baby. Mm-hmm. And you know, he might determine this is the best way, especially given how successful this lawsuit was, that it really might be a way to corner a market and prevent, you know, or at least, you know, cool down competition that, you know, is probably eating a little bit into the market line. There are a lot of people out there who, you know, would like to get iPhones but don't because there are cheaper knockoffs available. I'm not talking about the high end Android phones. I'm talking about the low end, you know, dumpy ones.
Right.
Those are the most popular. The clunk free, the ones that you can, the Android phone that you can get free on contract, those are the most popular of Android phones. So, and those people who bought that, got that free on their 2-year contract, they wish that they had the $200 or $300 or $400 that they could put up front for an iPhone. They wish they could, but they didn't. And just like, you know what? I'll take this one. It's free, and I don't have to, you know, put more money into this. I know we're at an interesting perspective. I think what's going to be interesting is, does the iPhone 4 become free on contract with the iPhone 5 coming out? Because the iPhone 4S will be $99. Because the iPhone 4 was really a really good product. You know what I mean? Like it was it looks like the 4S. It's the 5 will look different. But you guys, could you imagine the 4 for free on contract would probably be an incredible deal.
Has Apple ever had one of their iPhones free on contract before?
3GS is free on contract. Has been free on contract for about a year, with AT&T. So, the iPhone 4 free on contract, which I think would be an incredible seller. So
yeah,
I don't know. The screen looks really, you know, the screen looked really good. It just, I can't imagine, like, the people would, either a low-end Android phone or an iPhone 4 for a 2-year contract, what would you choose?
You know, I'm kind of addicted to the new, so I'm going to be getting the iPhone, the next iPhone.
My wife would probably get one, though, you know. I would probably buy one for her. I mean, if I was buying something for a non tech person, I would probably, you know, very seriously go towards that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think I'll probably be waiting an iteration, because I think it's my wife's turn to get the new iPhone, so that we don't, because we have separate contracts, and I think I'm still on my 2-year contract for the last iPhone, so.
I for a new 2-year contract with the iPhone 4S the weekend that it came out. So I've got some soul searching to do.
Exactly. It's like the biggest first world problem ever.
I could sell it, right? I could sell this on Craigslist and then just buy the iPhone 5 unlocked, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then just continue to use it on the same contract that I have, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So that seems like the most logical idea for me, because that way it doesn't screw with my contract, and I get the new phone, and maybe I have to pay another few hundred bucks or something, but then I have the cool new iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough dilemma.
Lots of soul searching. Yes.
Any last thoughts on Apple versus Samsung before we wrap this show up for the night?
Do you guys like feel Samsung is still in a really good position?
I think I have to agree with Farhad Manju's assessment that even though they took a hit, I mean, look at the upside for them at the end of this. I mean, they're going to be okay. I'm not going to weep too much for Samsung.
Yeah, I'm more worried, honestly, about the other handset makers that are out there that either are smaller or, Google, for example. Google is just one and even a smaller handset maker, but it still puts them in a not great position relative to their partners. And, Motorola is definitely another company within the possible, sites of Apple if they decide to build on this. Let's not forget that, courts build on each other, so this ruling could be very useful in Apple's additional patent lawsuits that they make against other companies. So, I don't know, I'd be worried if I was Google probably more than if I was Samsung. Samsung basically pays their fine and, tries not to do as much close copying anymore. Google has to figure out exactly how to build their strategy in a way that doesn't get them sued.
I think Google has the funds and the power to you know, figure this out. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. and Android itself is coming great too. So I don't know. I think Google will be fine. And Motorola is owned by Google now, so Motorola's probably covered. They have the heft of Google behind them. I think HTC. I don't know. There's
I think HTC is dying. Yeah, for other reasons.
I agree.
But yeah, HTC has another thing to be worried about. Let's put it that way.
Yeah,
I think we're going to see a more of a consolidation amongst brands. Until I mean, we're gonna have Android, we're gonna have Windows Phone and the iPhone, and everyone else is going to be in fourth place.
Mm.
Completely. And I mean, there is like RIM is done, right? It's completely mm-hmm. It's a joke, right? Yeah. BlackBerry is there's no way it can come back, right? Unless BlackBerry 10 was like amazing.
Yeah.
It would have to leapfrog, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'd like to see that. I'd like to see whatever it is that they've got up their sleeves. And then we'll enjoy that for a couple of weeks, and then it'll be gone.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll save our BlackBerry musings for another time, I guess.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to start with you, Sean, since you're our guest tonight. Where can we find your work online when you're not here helping us out on the show?
Yeah, you can find me at venturebeat.com. You can find me on twitter.com/SeanLudwig. You can find me at SeanLudwig.com. It's my collected presence. And I'm sure there's a lot of other places you can find me too if you Google my name. I think I own like all the top Google results for my names. You know, that's cool.
you've done some terrific SEO for yourself.
Thank
you. Chris, how about yourself? Where can we find you online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can find me most often at twitter.com/ChrisBurnor, ChrisBurnor. I try to keep a fairly regular Twitter conversation going. And I blog at chrisburnor.com. And if you're interested in sort of startup news and articles, I co-curate a newsletter of the best startup events and essays and writings and whatnot every Monday and Friday at startupdigest.com.
All right. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com. gplus.to/MrBabyMan is the link to my Google Plus account. At least until Google Plus starts rolling out the vanity URLs to myself, which they haven't done yet. You can check out past episodes of The Drill Down as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Go to geeksofdoom.com and we're in the upper right-hand sidebar. Our show is on Stitcher. You can listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and other devices by going to stitcher.com. Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. If you've got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@TheDrillDown.com. If you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@TheDrillDown.com for us to publish on the site. Let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.